This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, coming up here is the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference 2025 session about forest management. So they've got a lot to cover, so let's get right to it. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
I'm Dr. Chad Hansen. I'm a forest and fire biologist with the John Muir Project. I'm just noticing that's our old address, so our new address, current address, is on our website. The rest of the information behind me is accurate. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit today about a dominant narrative, a very common narrative that is basically governing the conversation about forests and fire, and what we should do and how we should manage and where we should focus our resources and our attention. And that's basically the narrative that the denser forests, in other words, more carbon-rich forests, forests that haven't burned in a long time, that they will burn much more intensely. And that's a bad thing, but also just that they will burn more intensely. And so if we want to have lower intensity fires, we have to remove a bunch of trees and a bunch of carbon from the forest. That's the narrative out there. So I want to talk about that a little bit because I see it as a dangerous narrative because it's diverting and focusing resources out into the forest wildlands. Oftentimes these giant logging projects are implemented increasingly under the rubric of community protection based on this notion that somehow if we remove millions of trees from the forest, it's going to stop the fires from reaching the towns. It'll protect the towns. And that's diverting resources away, it's diverting attention away, it's giving communities a certain sense of security that I argue is false. It's also pitting climate change mitigation imperatives against biodiversity conservation, which I think is dangerous. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit because that's bad news. The good news is that there's a whole lot of science that tells us that despite the fact that these things make intuitive sense, that the forest is denser, it's going to burn more intensely. If it hasn't burned in a long time, it'll burn more intensely. The science is telling us, the overwhelming majority of the science is telling us the opposite, that actually denser forests tend to burn at lower intensity. I'll talk a little bit about why that is. But I can only, of course, cover just a little bit of the science in this short presentation. We have a lot more about this on our website, John Muir Project website. And I'm always happy to follow up with folks by email or phone to talk more about it. All right, so this is research by Zoll and Dunn. They look specifically at this issue of whether forests with higher biomass burn more intensely. And this is increasing biomass, and that line up there is fire severity, basically a function of tree mortality. Fire severity going down as biomass goes up. So why is that? How can that be? Because what we hear is if you have a denser forest, you have a lot more fuel. And if there's more fuel, of course, it's going to burn more intensely. Well, on the one hand, that's true. On the surface, you have more biomass. You have more things that theoretically or ostensibly could burn. But what you also have are countervailing factors. You have more canopy cover. You have more cooling shade from that canopy cover. You have more moisture retention. You have higher relative humidity because of that higher canopy cover, because of the additional shade. Because you have so much canopy cover, you have less combustible vegetation in the understory, fewer grasses because they need a lot of sunlight, for example. Everything stays more moist on the forest floor, even in the middle of summer. And because you have a denser forest, you also have more of a windbreak against the winds that drive the flames. And that wind buffer, that wind resistance that the denser stand provides is actually a key factor. And we find the same thing looking at that same question from a slightly different perspective. If the forest hasn't burned in a very, very long time, typically it's going to be much denser. So, you know, different researchers have looked at this question too. TSF means time since fire. So this bar here, this is areas that haven't burned in over 75 years. And then when they burn, that black bar is high severity. This is moderate and that's low. And what you see there is that in the forests that had not burned in the longest period of time, they did not have higher levels of high severity. They actually had lower levels of high severity. I was not a co-author of this study, but I've researched this on my own, and we just didn't find any difference. We didn't find lower levels of high severity. We just didn't find any difference at all. So that wasn't really the issue. That's not to say that previous fire doesn't influence subsequent fire. It absolutely does. There's a lot of research on that. But it's typically in a very short period of time after the last fire. It could be a few years, it could be several years, it could be a little bit longer, but it's not indefinite. And the assumption was, if a previous fire influences fire intensity, fire severity for a few years, then 10 years later, it'll be even bigger. 20 years later, there'll be even more fuel accumulation, even more intensity. 50 years later, et cetera. And it doesn't work that way. It's not a linear increase. And a big part of this, of course, is that the entire conversation is misplaced and misdirected. This is not fundamentally a forest density issue. This is a weather and climate change issue. That is the fundamental thing that drives fires. If you have a drought year and you have hot, dry, windy conditions and you have an ignition, guess what? You're gonna have a larger, fast-moving fire that is not gonna be suppressible. That's a fact. This is a climate issue, fundamentally. Now, that's not to say that forest density is totally irrelevant. It's not. It is a secondary factor, but the interesting thing is it's a secondary factor in the opposite direction from what most people assume. Denser, more carbon-rich, you have a microclimate that is actually functioning as a climate buffer against the extreme weather driven by climate change in a fire. And I'll mention here, I was a co-author of this study. This is the largest scientific analysis ever done on this question in North America. We analyzed 1,500 fires over three decades. And the question we looked at was one that was posed by politicians again and again, but they hadn't gathered the data. And they said, well, if you have forests with higher levels of environmental protection, that means you have a lot less management. And if you have a lot less management, that means you have denser forests because you're not pulling all those trees out of the forest. So they're gonna burn much more severely. And so they were proposing to roll back environmental laws and pass large sweeping bills that would increase logging on federal lands under the guise of fire management. They hadn't done the math on it. We looked at the question, and what we found is that forests with the highest levels of protection and no logging actually had the lowest levels of fire severity. And forests with the fewest environmental protections and the most tree removal had the highest levels of fire severity. And that's after controlling for forest types. So this was all in the same forest types. Contrary to, you know, popular wisdom, but this is what we found. And again, it doesn't make sense initially to a lot of folks, but it does once you think about it a little bit more deeply in terms of the microclimate effects. A lot of the modeling work out there, I don't tend to rely on modeling studies. I tend to rely on studies that deal with real fires and real forests. But it's important to note that even a lot of the modeling studies out there are finding that when you remove trees from forests, in more cases than not, it actually increases fire severity. And that really doesn't even get talked about in a lot of the environmental assessments and environmental impact statements that the Forest Service, for example, is turning out. And even a lot of the folks, the scientists who are really promoting thinning and promoting this idea that the forests are too dense, they're overgrown, and we need to remove vast amounts of carbon from the forest to restore them and to curb fires, even a lot of those folks are actually finding in their results things that are contrary to what they're saying when they're quoted in the press. This is Stevens et al. 2021. Dr. Stevens is one of the primary proponents of thinning, but he found that as thinning occurred, surface fire rate of spread increased. In other words, it goes to what I was saying earlier, that if you have a less dense forest, you have less wind resistance, and the flames will sweep through the fire, the air of the forest, faster than a denser forest. And what that means, of course, is that fires will reach a town, a vulnerable community, more quickly. If a fire is moving faster, it means there's less time to evacuate. And there's less time for first responders to get to the community and help people evacuate. Not everyone can evacuate easily on their own. Some folks need some help. And there's less time to make that a safe process, less time for first responders to do last minute defensible space work and structure defense. And that has tragic consequences. And so I'm gonna talk about that a little bit too. But first, this is a study I did in 2021. This is the Creek Fire, a big fire that occurred in 2020 in the southern Sierra Nevada. I looked at this question from a different perspective. I looked at different management categories. Post-fire logging that was done under the rubric of fuel reduction, supposedly to reduce future fire severity. I looked at private forest lands where they had done 40 years of thinning and burning. I looked at commercial thinning, and I looked at just general forest lands with no management. Basically, what I found was that the areas where logging had occurred, whether it was thinning, commercial thinning, or post-fire logging, they actually had the highest levels of fire severity, not the lowest. And this was a very large fire, so very large analysis covering a large landscape, 380,000 acre fire. And this is a pretty typical example of what most of the really dense forests burned like in this fire. This is the Creek Fire. This burned at just a low intensity surface fire. You can't even tell that the forest burned, but this was a surface fire area, and this is what most of the really dense forests, this is how most of the dense forests in the Creek Fire burned. Another example here, you see a little bit of tree mortality in the kind of really very small understory size classes, but again, very creeping surface fire, and this is pretty typical. Now, that's not to say that none of the dense forests burned at high intensity. Of course, they did when the weather dictated that result, but all things being equal, they tended to burn a little bit lower. Now, on the opposite side of the scale, in the areas that have been commercially thinned, based on this notion that removing most of the trees will create open stands, it will prevent crown fire because it's removing the ladder fuels that will otherwise climb into the canopy. I'm here to tell you that that notion is not well-founded. It doesn't really work that way. The crown fire can and will operate when there's almost no ladder fuels. This area has been heavily thinned, and of course, in that main middle open area, there really weren't any trees supposedly to carry the flames into the crown. But the flames go from the ground up, and they don't really need the small trees to get higher. They need the weather to be right, dry conditions, hot conditions, and enough of the fine material on the surface of the forest floor to carry flames and create that combustion. Small twigs, pine needles, dry leaves, etc. This is an area that is even more open. And again, both of these areas were heavily thinned based on the idea that it would prevent the potential for crown fire. Crown fire is not possible in an area that's this open and low density. But of course, many of the areas that they logged this way did burn crown fire. And these are not unusual or exceptional examples. This is actually fairly common. And again, this is not to say that a thinned area can't burn at low intensity. That happens all the time too, when the weather is right and when the weather dictates that. And this is a vast area of private lands. This is Southern California Edison forest lands, and they had been thinning and burning in this forest for 40 years. And that's where one of the largest high-intensity fire patches in the Creek Fire occurred. And again, it's not because they were thinning and burning that the crown fire occurred. It's because that's what the weather and climate conditions on that day at that moment dictated. In other words, that wasn't really the issue. It's about weather and climate. And this is an area on Forest Service land just across over the ridge that they had heavily post-fire logged years earlier in an earlier fire, and they said that all the removal of the dead trees, that would prevent a future high-intensity fire. And many of those areas that they post-fire logged burned extremely intensely later when the Creek Fire burned. So it did not prevent high-intensity fire. The other thing that the Forest Service leaves out of this conversation, and this is a really important one, is what we call cumulative severity. We also call it cumulative mortality. There are a lot of studies, and this is what confuses a lot of people. They say, well, look, I know there's a bunch of studies by the Forest Service going back 20, 25 years that say that thinning effectively reduces fire severity, and draw that conclusion. You're absolutely right that there are those studies. The problem is that most of those studies are theoretical modeling studies. They don't use actual fires. And the ones that actually do pertain to actual fires do not account for the tree mortality from thinning itself. And this is a pretty big factor, okay? It's a massive source of bias. If they were only reducing 5% or 10% of the trees, that might be a different thing. But a lot of these thinning projects, as a lot of folks in this room know, if you walk the ground in these areas, we're not talking about 5 or 10%. We're talking about 30 or 40% on the low end, and oftentimes 50, 60, 70%. Increasingly, I'm seeing thinning projects where they're killing and removing 80, 90% of the trees in the stand. Okay, and then the fire comes through and they ignore the 80 or 90 or 70% of the trees they killed before the fire, and they only focus on what was left after. And so if you have slightly fewer of the trees that remain after thinning that were killed by the fire, they say, oh, well, thinning was effective, right? So, you know, that's again, a massive source of bias. And this is true of all of the studies that have been produced by the Forest Service over the last 25 years. They do not account for tree mortality from thinning. So that is a problem. What we found is that when you account for it, that the tree overall tree mortality from thinning plus fire is much higher than tree mortality from fire itself. It's a pretty big deal. So this is not an effective way to go. And from a community protection standpoint, what it all means is these fires are reaching these communities, oftentimes reaching them faster than they otherwise would because of the tree removal, and they're burning down towns and oftentimes killing a lot of people. And that is a tragedy that is preventable because we do not have to focus our resources on giant logging projects out in the forest telling communities it's somehow going to save them from fire. The community of Grizzly Flats was told explicitly by the Forest Service that this giant thinning project far from the town would stop a fire from ever reaching the town. That was a direct communication to the community. People didn't do the defensible space pruning around their homes. They didn't do the home hardening. They didn't put ember-proof vents on their homes. They didn't get the dry pine needles and leaves off their roofs. They thought they were covered because the Forest Service told them, you don't have to worry about it. The Caldor fire came from the south of Grizzly Flats. It blew through those thinned areas at mostly high intensity, and it burned down the town. Grizzly Flats is gone. That did not have to happen. And this is Grizzly Flats here. That's where the fire started. And these are the thinned areas. There are a lot of other types of logging, so I haven't shown those. Clear cuts and you know, various types of logging that wouldn't be characterized as thinning, and those burned at high intensity too. But the point is that these areas did not act as fuel breaks. They did not stop the fire from reaching the town. Same thing in the Caldor fire on the eastern side, where we saw the fire going through, burning right through these thinned areas. You can see the green and purple polygons. They didn't stop the fire. But where the fire did actually stop is at defensible space areas right next to homes. Here and here. And these were areas, there was no logging. It was just pruning. They removed seedlings, saplings. They removed some lower limbs within, you know, 100, 200 feet of the homes or the private property boundary. And that actually did make a difference, especially with the water drops right next to the community. And this is the campfire in 2018. Fire started 15, 16 miles east of the community of Paradise. It burned through some of the most heavily logged forest in the entire northern Sierra Nevada, some of the most heavily logged forest in the western United States. Massive areas of thinning, green tree removal, massive areas of post-fire logging, removing dead trees, all under the rubric of the guise of community protection, fuel reduction to prevent the fire from reaching the community. The fire spread through that logged area in about 5 hours. That's the fastest and most intense that the fire burned in the entire 151,000 acre fire by far. That's what burned through fastest. It burned down 14,000 homes and killed 86 people. This again was preventable. This did not have to happen. And it's not that the fire would not have reached the community if it hadn't been for all the logging. It would have, because that's what the wind was doing. That's what the weather was doing. It was driving the fire to the west and the southwest, and it was hot, dry, and windy, and the fire was going to get there. It wouldn't have got there as fast, but it was going to get there. But what wouldn't have happened if we had focused on community safety, and if the resources had been provided and the assistance to the community? Some people wouldn't have taken it, but others would have. A lot of those homes would, most of those homes would not have burned. The home hardening, the defensible space pruning, the evacuation planning and assistance, that would have happened. Instead of the community thinking, we don't have to worry about it because the fire's not going to get here, because the Forest Service and the logging company told us that that giant logging project out there miles away over the ridge is going to stop the fire from getting here. That was a dangerous lie. And these are just a few examples. There are many, many other examples of this, but one of the ones I want to talk about briefly before I turn it over to my co-panelists is the recent fires in Los Angeles. Now, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, just passed, the House of Representatives just passed the so-called Fix Our Forests Act. Fix Our Forests Act, for those of you who haven't heard of it, is a logging bill disguised that would roll back environmental laws and increase logging massively on federal lands across the nation, supposedly, among other things, to protect communities from fire. Now, the reality is that most of the communities that are at greatest risk from wildfire are nowhere near a forest. They are in grasslands, they are in oak woodlands, they're in the chaparral habitat, but they're not in a forest. And so not only are the communities that are in forests not being protected by this approach of logging out the wildlands and telling people it's going to stop the fire from reaching them, but most of the communities that are at greatest risk are not even in forests. So I'm going to talk about this. Okay, sorry, this is the Dixie Fire. This is another example before I get to the LA fires. This is a huge area of thinning before the fire. You can see the thinning here. This area was all thinned. And this is actually kind of like on the lower end of thinning intensity. And this is how it burned. It burned at almost 100% crown fire. Just north of this image is the community of Canyon Dam, which was destroyed. Canyon Dam, that town is gone now. Again, this was done, telling the town it would save them from fire. And this is what used to be Altadena, a town that I know very, very well in Los Angeles area. These areas were three and a half miles from the National Forest boundary. And even on the National Forest, it's not forest until you go about 5 miles further into the mountains and climb about 4,000 feet. Then you start getting up into some conifers. But like the fire burned through chaparral entirely. And these homes and the businesses, they burned from a massive ember ring. None of these ever came in contact with the fire. These burned from ignitions from embers and extreme winds. 100-mile-an-hour gusts, and 5% relative humidity. So again, you know, if we want to walk the talk and care about protecting communities from fire, this is not a forest management issue. This is a community protection issue. And we have to focus entirely a different way from the home out. Now, I'll talk briefly before I sign off here about a trio of articles produced by some Forest Service scientists, Pritchard et al., Hagman et al., and Hesberg et al. This was in 2021 in a single issue of a particular scientific journal. My colleagues and I in De La Sala et al., 2022, we addressed these three articles, and we found that they had... they falsely claimed that the science was settled. That's what they claimed. We don't need to talk about this anymore. Thinning works. Let's do a lot more thinning. It'll stop the fires. It'll protect the communities. What we found is that even in their study, they had to admit over and over and over again the contrary conclusion to what they were promoting. They had to admit that thinning causes higher surface field loads. It can contribute to high-intensity surface fire, elevated levels of tree mortality, elevated fire intensities. Thinning can increase surface wind speed and fuel heating, which increases the rate of fire spread in thinned forests. It can increase the risk of fire by increasing sunlight exposure to the forest floor, drying vegetation, increasing wind speeds. You know, the things I was talking about earlier in terms of the microclimate effects, they had to admit this over and over and over again, and then inexplicably at the end they say the science of cell and thinning is highly effective and stop talking about anything to the contrary. I call that an example of bias. But we looked into, in De La Sala et al. 2022, we looked into even the studies they cited for the proposition that thinning is highly effective. And the studies didn't say what they claimed. One found that thinned forests had mostly higher intensity fire. Another one, the conclusion said thinning is effective, but if you looked at the results, it showed the opposite, that the reburn of the previous wildfires had the lower fire intensity, whereas the thinned forests actually had higher intensity. And then the other one, Jochen Kent, found that thinned forests had fewer live trees and less carbon than areas that just burned in the wildfires. So This was not actually supporting their argument, and yet these were cited as evidence of support. So we did a very, very large analysis of the entire body of studies that they had cited for the proposition that historical forests were much less dense, much more open. And what we found is that they had omitted vast bodies of scientific evidence to form that conclusion. And that when all that omitted evidence was included, the conclusion was historical forests were far denser than they had claimed. Now, that's not to say there weren't open forests. Those were there too, but there was a real mix of open and dense forests. It wasn't all just open forests. And we found that they had actually falsified the scientific record. Last thing I'll cover is just the notion that if you have forests with more dead trees, they're always gonna burn more intensely. There's a lot of science on this too. The largest and most comprehensive studies are either finding no effect of higher densities of dead trees, or they're finding that forests with more dead trees tend to burn at lower intensities. That's what this research finds. Now, again, that may seem counterintuitive. People say, no, that can't be right. But then they've done their own studies, and they tend to find the same thing. Now, I have my own theories about why that is. I think it has to do with microclimate effects there, too. Dead trees fall, down logs soak up and store 25 times more water per cubic foot than the surrounding soil. They act like giant sponges more than anything else, in addition to providing habitat and cycling nutrients. So I will stop it there because I know there's limited time, but I'm happy to answer questions afterwards. Thank you.
Chad, that was amazing. Hello, everybody. My name is Paula Hood. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm co-director of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project works to protect and restore Eastern Oregon Cascades and the Blue Mountains in Eastern Oregon and Southeastern Washington. And field surveying is the heart of the work that we do. We're in the field from the beginning of June through September every year. And our staff and volunteers spend thousands of hours every field season surveying proposed timber sales. And I've been with BMVP for almost 10 years and engaged in similar work for a little over 20 years. And I have an academic background in environmental science. And so I wanted to highlight our field survey perspective on some of these issues. So, and focusing in on Eastern Oregon and East Side Forest, because that's where we work. So a lot of people don't think too much about East Side Forest. Some of you do, a lot of you don't. And most people aren't aware that actually east of the Cascades in Oregon, there are the east side of the state encompasses half of the forests in the state. So really a lot of the forests are actually on the east side of the Cascade Crest and deserve a lot more attention than they usually get. I also want to point out that not all the forests on the east side are dry ponderosa pine forests, which you hear a lot, and it's part of the wildfire narrative of needing ostensibly, supposedly, to log these forests. But anyway, so a lot of these forests can be downright lush. This is actually a picture from the Mount Hare National Forest near the Middle Fork of the John Day River. And really there's just this amazing array of like a complex mosaic of forest types on the east side. So you get everything from sagebrush, juniper, dry open ponderosa pine, very, very moist mixed conifer forests, and sometimes all within a really short distance from each other. So it's pretty cool out there. If you don't spend a lot of time, I suggest checking it out. Our field work tends to focus on timber sales before they have been logged, and we use the information that we collect on the ground to fight for those forests. But we've also started increasingly looking a little bit more at forests that have recently been logged. We still focus mostly on proposed timber sales, but we've started to do a little bit more post-logging work. And so I want to give a few examples. So this is the Lex timber sale in Deschutes National Forest. There's Mount Bachelor. All of these sales that we field survey have been characterized by the Forest Service and timber industry and the collaboratives as not as logging, but as fuels reduction and fuels management or restoration. And what we're finding, unfortunately, all too often, is that this is very different from what we find on the ground in the field. And so in addition to the key issues that Chad discussed, that thinning to address wildfire is an ineffective and outdated strategy, a false solution. So those are very crucial discussion issues and points. And in addition to that, we're finding frequently that there is this huge discrepancy between what even the Forest Service is calling thinning and what the reality looks like when we get out there and look at the post-logging practices. And so this is Lex Timber Sale, there's no bachelor. The description of this was to treat roughly 6,500 acres to restore historic species composition, structure, and process. This is the Forest Service quote. Treatments would include fuels reduction and prescribed burning, so then, you know, that fuels piece. Here's a couple pictures from the ground view of that timber sale. And then that timber sale, as is often the case, is near another big timber sale. So just south of the Lex Project, which is at the north, Lex Timber Sale, there's the Junction Timber Sale. And this was actually the first timber sale I commented on when I joined BMVP on staff. And so this one was described reducing hazardous fuels to protect values at risk from wildfire, and that included values such as scenic corridors and wildlife habitats. And the Forest Service described it as reducing stocking in ponderosa pine stands to increase vigor and resilience to insects, disease, and wildfire. And I want to take just a minute and note a few of the many euphemisms used for logging. So I've been doing this work for over 20 years now, and while logging itself, logging on the ground, has largely remained the same, the Forest Service's framing of that logging continues to evolve and is increasingly greenwashed. And so here are some examples: fuels reduction, fuels management, resiliency, vegetation management, integrated vegetation management, somebody who's feeling very clever, restoration, fire, insects, disease management, community safety, etc. Here's another example. So here's recent logging in the South George Vegetation Management Project, and this was ostensibly to improve vigor, health, and fire resistance within a forested ecosystem. This is recent logging in the Walton Lake Sale in the Ochoco National Forest, and this was also billed as a restoration project. And while this actually focused a little more on ostensibly addressing disease, they've also had a fuels reduction component. So the rationales for logging have changed over the years, and that's true even while logging and the problems caused by logging have remained largely the same. And it has also remained a consistent theme that the Forest Service claims that the very problems caused by logging will somehow be fixed by more logging. And so nowadays, the main greenwashing on the east side is that it's framed as a solution to wildfire, and logging is sold to the public as necessary to protect communities from wildfire, even when it's done, as Chad was discussing, far in the backcountry, very far away from communities. Similarly to what you said, there's also, most of the structures in the western U.S. are lost to grass fires, not forest fires. Who doesn't like a good restoration project? Right? Especially when it's built by the agency as keeping the public safe from wildfire. And often thinning and fuels reduction are understood by much of the public to be just cutting a few trees, understory trees. And the agency promotes this understanding because they know that most of the public is not actually on board with logging of old growth trees or virtual clear cutting or other heavy industrial logging practices. This is the Big Mosquito Project, which I want to talk about for just a second. And this was heavily promoted by the agency and by the collaborative group on the Malheur National Forest and timber industry as restoration needed to protect old growth ponderosa pine trees. And so some of that description from the agency included things like a suite of activities to restore forest resiliency and including fuels treatments. One of the main reasons put forth for the sale was to reduce fuel loading by reducing the density of standing vegetation, surface fuels, and/or ladder fuels. This is actually a picture of what from the Forest Service itself in the NEPA documents. So this was what they were showing the public during the public comment process, what the public could expect forests would look like after a different euphemism, free selection thinning. That was kind of a unique one. So this was supposedly what it looked like after logging was done. And so I got curious because this was really touted as a pushed as a successful restoration project for logging to save old ponderosa pines. And so we had actually field surveyed this sale before it was logged. And so here on the left side is one of our volunteers, Brenna, in the sale pre-logging. And then this side is actually that same unit, that same slope, but just viewed from the different direction after logging. And so this is, you know, this was actually the first place that I found when I got out of the truck. Like, we got out of the truck looking for for logging, and we were just like, oh my God. So anyway, yeah, this does not strike me as thinning. And so we also found lots and lots of old growth ponderosa pines cut down, unfortunately. And so we had time to document about 30. There were many more, and this was just one sale unit in several thousands of acres of timber sale. Also this free selection thinning with skyline logging. This particular unit was about 80 acres. They still had about 720 more acres to go of this logging that hadn't started when we were field surveying. So we're very concerned that more of this is gonna happen. But of the ones, the old growth ponderosa pines that we found cut down, about a third of them were over 200 years old, and most of them were over 150, which is how the Forest Service defines old growth. So some were over 200, some were over 300. And so, you know, we're really, and I should note that these old growth ponderosa pine trees were technically not targeted for logging, but they were part of logging implementation. And so specifically in this, there were cable corridors. We met with the Forest Service in the field to discuss our concerns. They stood by this as restoration, and they also confirmed that these trees were taken to the mill and sold, even though they weren't officially targeted for logging. And then, you know, this is not also an isolated incident. Here's next door in the Camp Lick timber sale. This was also considered commercial thinning. This is a stand improvement, another euphemism, commercial thinning from the Camp Lick sale. And this is another stand improvement commercial thinning unit from the Camp Lick sale. There was also lots of old growth ponderosa pine trees that we documented cut down as part of logging implementation, even though they weren't specifically officially targeted, but there they were cut down and sold. So that was extremely concerning to us. The Camp Lick sale also had some biomass logging as a part of it, incidentally. Here are some more examples of sales that had wild, like fuels reduction, community safety, restoration rationales for them. And these were shared with us from Rob Clavins at Oregon Wild from the Wallah Whitman National Forest. I do want to be fully clear and transparent that not all recent logging that we have field surveying is a virtual clear cut or includes logging of old and large trees. A lot of it doesn't. But that said, even when it doesn't, we still find widespread issues that we're extremely concerned about. And that includes things like soil damage, erosion, fine sediment delivering to streams, road-related damage, degradation or destruction of wildlife and wildlife habitats. And so we still remain very concerned even when it's not some of that other logging that I showed you. And make no mistake, logging is happening on a very widespread basis in eastern Oregon. And so I'm going to continue to pick up Mount Muir National Forest for a minute. So this map was actually made by the Nature Conservancy for one of the collaborative groups on the Mount Muir. And both the crosshatch and the fully colored polygons shapes show logging projects. So this depicts that essentially the entirety of the Mount Muir National Forest, save just a little bit, is covered by a logging project. And so the only difference for these different, like the crosshatching and the colors, are that some of these, at the time this map was made, had been recently signed decisions, so logging was already underway or had even been completed recently. Some of these were currently being proposed and some were up and coming. But, you know, and the Mount Muir is not unique in increasing the pace and scale of logging and having these extensive logging projects, many of which run back to back. I also want to note that unfortunately, the Forest Service on the east side is increasingly going into ecologically sensitive areas, and that includes mature and old forest, streamside riparian corridors that are directly adjacent to streams that were supposed to be the buffers from logging, and moist mixed conifer forests, steep slope, and sometimes even roadless areas. And I also want to note that, one of the collateral damage aspects of this is carbon storage, as Chad discussed a bit. And so, for example, in eastern Oregon, there was recent research by Dr. David Muldrexler and his colleagues showing that large trees make up only 3% of trees on the east side, which is very small number compared to historic norms. And large trees are desperately needed by wildlife and are at a deficit across the landscape. And also that these 3% of trees that are large, over 21 inches, store the vast majority of the carbon, so 42% of the carbon, yet they're being targeted increasingly by the Forest Service with attempts at rollback of protections for large trees and things like that. So, and most of this is, again, under the guise of thinning to prevent or control wildfires. I also want to note that a lot of fuels reduction also targets wildlife habitat in particular. So fuels reduction, the fuels that are being targeted are the same habitats that wildlife sometimes depend on, depending on the species and the forest type. And so these fuels are the very habitat components that are needed by some species to survive. And that's especially true for species that are associated with or depend on mature and old forests, multi-layered canopies, denser forests, snags, and logs. So, unfortunately, what I'm getting at here is that there's a lot of collateral damage that is largely downplayed or entirely ignored by timber industry, Forest Service, collaborative groups, and that results from this log it to save it from wildfire kind of strategy. And Eastern Oregon in particular has just amazing biodiversity. These pictures were all taken in proposed timber sales by BMBP staff and volunteers, mostly by Karen, who's in the audience somewhere. And as part of this, I would be remiss if I did not mention that part of this collateral damage is the result of timber sale infrastructure such as roads. And so timber sales rely on roads. They need lots and lots and lots of roads. And so again, I'm continuing to pick on the map here since you've already seen the map here. This is a map of existing roads on the Malheur National Forest. And I've pulled this data off the Malheur National Forest GIS library. And so the Malheur National Forest has over 3.5 miles per square mile on average of road. That actually jumps to over 4 miles per square mile if you take out roadless and wilderness areas. And so this kind of road density is well recognized, well documented to be detrimental to fish, to water quality, to wildlife habitats, and also it is in violation of their own forest plan standards. So both the Malheur, for example, and the Malawitman National Forest each have over 9,000 miles of road. You can pretty much drive to each corner of the country and still not go as many miles as are encompassed in each of those national forests. Given the logging road densities, it's not surprising that national forests in eastern Oregon have a huge stream temperature problem. And so this is, you can see streams with water quality limited and impaired waters in eastern Oregon. And it's a huge problem on federal public lands, and stream water temperature is the most widespread water quality impairment. So over 1,240 miles of stream on national forests in the Blue Mountains are listed as not meeting water quality criteria. And I know this is a little bit of field of the kind of direct wildfire issue, but for me, when I think about the collateral damage of all this logging and all these roads, one of the first place my mind jumps to and my heart jumps to is the damage being done to water quality, wildlife, fish, also drinking water. I think I might be at time. Real quick, I wanted to just mention that, in eastern Oregon and other places, there are still large blocks of core habitats that are incredibly important for wildlife. Key connectivity corridors still exist. And I really want to see us protect these places and not lose this opportunity before they disappear. And especially in the age of climate change and biodiversity crises, this becomes ever more important, partly for allowing species to be able to adapt to climate change, to migrate, to continue to exist, or at least give them the best chance of continuing to exist. And so we really need a paradigm shift away from these false narratives. As Chad mentioned, most of the logging is proposed deep in the woods, far from homes and communities, and logging in the backcountry does not make homes or communities any safer. And really, really quick, I just wanted to kind of rip through these, kind of, you know, a little bit building on some of this narrative. So this is a timber sale unit that was in the Camp Lick sale. That is across the street, not a timber sale unit, old logging unit. These really important wildlife habitats, these mature and old forests, are what are being targeted. So this is a timber sale unit that was proposed in the South George sale. This is in that same area, not a timber sale unit, but old logging. So it's like this checkerboard of these plantations that are often very dense, have been logged in the not too distant past, and are, you know, here you can see kind of the erosion coming down from the old clear cut. And unfortunately, they're targeting what's left in this, you know, sometimes checkerboard of these plantations. Here's what some of that logging looked like in that same timber sale that we surveyed. Similarly, this is a sale unit in the Malheur and the Austin sale, this beautiful mixed conifer forest. This is right next door to that sale unit, literally right next door. And so, you know, they're going after the remaining wildlife habitat, the remaining carbon storage, and, you know, potentially going to make us, the emissions, climate change worse by all this logging, right? And so here's a little bit more. This is an old unit of sale near where they are going after the remaining mature and old forests. So, that's it. Thank you, everybody.